we've been talking for since the beginning of the year, I've gone through a set of topics that are thought of in the early Buddhist system or appear in the early Buddhist discourses as what you could think of as like the preliminaries to Buddhist practice proper. And the passage that I've been working with appears in the texts when the Buddha gives a talk, often to someone who's coming off the street, who's like, "Hey, I heard you were awesome. You know, prove it to me." And he's like, and they often have a conversation, and then the Buddha gives a talk. And the talk that starts with these preliminaries, the sense that we get of it is that these are things that are that were common to the culture around him, or that aren't distinct to Buddhism. And this is important in a certain way. So this list that we just did 6 weeks on is giving, ethics, heavens, or the way that good actions lead to fortunate future existence and harmful actions lead to unfortunate future existence or births. The fourth topic is the danger in sensual pleasures. Basically, you like them too much, and then you behave badly because you like them too much. And fifth, the benefits in renunciation, that letting go is the heart of the whole path. That's the preliminaries. And in the passage, what the Buddha then says is, he gives that teaching. And then it says, and then when he discerned, when he could tell that the listener's mind was receptive, available, malleable. And this word malleable is really important. Like, you've heard the teachings, you're interested, and something happens where you go from being kind of like, prove it to me, teacher, to having a malleable mind, like a mind that can be changed, can be sculpted in a way. We could think of the malleable mind as like, I'm at ease enough, or I've been opened enough, that I'm available for my habits or my preconceived notions, my biases, we could say, to be shifted. And this is going to be important because the teaching the Buddha then gives, which is the Four Noble Truths, is called the teaching distinctive to the Buddhas. This is the thing that's not common to the culture around. And this is the thing that requires a malleable mind. It's going to demand that we change our core view of what reality is. So when the Buddha discerns that the mind is receptive, malleable, available, then he gives the teaching of the Four Noble Truths. That no particular experience can be ultimately satisfying in a permanent way. That everything changes constantly. That there's actually no fixed thing that doesn't change. No fixed identity, no fixed object. Everything is in a constant, perpetual flux. The cup is somewhere between being clay in a riverbank and clay again in a riverbank, essentially, if you really take the long arc of it, as it goes. And this essentially very short intermediate phase where it's a lovely sculpted cup that holds tea, in terms of like geological time, is a blip. Like, this was clay for a very long time. You know, before that it was other things getting compacted into clay, water, dirt, yada yada, minerals. It's clay for a very long time, and then there's this little flash of sunlight where it gets dug up, sculpted, baked, you know, used. And then, sooner or later, it'll crack. The studio will throw it out. It'll go into the landfill or the compost or whatever, the landfill. In the landfill, it'll get beaten up, cracked some more, broken down. Eventually, it becomes a kind of dusty gravel. You know? We have little bits of pottery from, like, when I lived at my first Zen center in the mountains of New Mexico, we would climb up to the ridge, and there were Anasazi ruins there. The Anasazi were the people that were there thousands of years before the people who later were there. Later on, there were like the Diné and the Hopi and the various Pueblo communities and cultures and nations that were there. Long before them, there were the Anasazi, who had a whole long culture that died out, that disappeared. And then there was nobody there for a while, and then these other cultures appeared. So, like, pottery shards They last a very, very long time. But eventually, we would go up there. It's just piles of pottery shards. We were like, oh, here's the place where when something broke, they tossed it. And it's broken pottery everywhere. You pick them up. But if you hang out there, you notice, like, oh, some bigger ones, you know, smaller, smaller, smaller. Maybe it takes 10,000 years for a broken cup to become gravel, and another 10 million for it to become indistinguishable dust. But in the scope of earthly time, that's not that much. How much more so this body? Where'd it come from, you know? My mama, in her unfathomable brilliance of being one who could mother, you know, with a slight contribution from this Puerto Rican guy from the Bronx, gave birth to this, or not actually this at all, right? Because what, I'm 48, so that's almost 49, that's almost 7 cycles. I've replaced every cell in this body. I haven't done anything. The cells have replaced themselves with new minerals, new 7 times over, they say, at least. Soon enough, hopefully not soon enough, but you know, in a relative blink of geologic time, this body once again is minerals, and much quicker, by the way, than the cup, right? You know, maybe you know, the thigh bone lasts the longest, a bit of skull, if well preserved. That's it. So everything impermanent, and then because of that, nothing having a truly permanent existence, including my sense of myself. So that's the teaching we're headed toward. So these prerequisites start off really with ethics, giving ethics the usefulness of good actions, heavens. And then they turn toward letting go. They say, watch out for pleasure, it'll bewitch you, better to let go. And then this profound deconstruction. Suffering, the cause of suffering in grasping, the release of suffering through practicing renunciation and wisdom. So this is a beautiful pathway, but the core deconstructive teachings, what I'm calling deconstructive is a kind of modern term for this very old inquiry. The core deconstructive teachings are pretty challenging, and they're challenging in a really distinct way. Especially the part that says, you know, as we chant in the opening chants, everything you love will be gone and taken away from you, including this body, including your life. And nothing can be grasped in any way. Nothing can be nailed down in any way. This is an incredible and kind of life-shaking teaching. But we know from so many conversations about these teachings, at least in our culture now, these are, I want to say, dangerous teachings. At the very least, I want to say these are what in psychology we would call ego dystonic, meaning the part of you who wants to feel comfortable knowing who you are, like you're a good human being, or you're worthy, or you're enough, or you're a good son or daughter or mother or father or child or civic participant or activist or member of any community. Like, all of those are identity markers, you know? And we need them. We need them. I identify with being a member of my family. I identify with my skin color, with my sexuality, with my gender, with my class, my culture. And most of those identity markers come about and are strongest when there is oppression or when there's threat or harm coming from elsewhere. In other words, it's useful for me to identify, for instance, as queer when the culture around me is intolerant to queerness, and therefore I need to find other folks who identify as queer to feel safer. I need to be in spaces where I feel safe, and there's folks that are enough like me. And this is true, you know, in so many ways, right? You know, over in Britain, poor old Britain, who nearly destroyed the world, is now once again arguing with itself about whether there should be a border in Ireland. Between essentially the Catholics and the Protestants. As in, if we don't figure out how to live together, the Catholics and the Protestants will kill each other on this border, as happened for so many years. Right? And those are identities where there's oppression, there's violence, there's separation. And the identity fixates or calcifies when it needs to protect itself. And then we might understand that our modern world is full of violence. It's full of oppression based on identity markers. So you may be threatened or harmed because of your race, because of your sex, your gender, your class, your upbringing, in so many different ways. This being true, then, many folks now hear that teaching. Everything is empty. There's no real self there. Everything just arises based on impersonal conditions and dissolves based on impersonal conditions. And there's all sorts of people, and particularly folks who are oppressed or feel oppression, who very distinctly and very self-consciously and wisely reject that teaching. At least in a, you know, that's not the right teaching for me right now kind of way. And that's appropriate, right? That's a teaching that says, don't cling to your identities, don't cling to yourself. But in the face of oppression, but also even just in the face of all sorts of other trauma, it may not be useful. I'm relatively privileged. I don't consider myself to be part of an oppressed identity group particularly, even though I share some qualities as being mixed race and queer, but not enough so of either that I've experienced direct oppression, I would say. There's some argument about that out there. But lots of privilege here. However, my situation also is that I was adopted, and so my family attachment realm is pretty wonked. As in, I don't feel in my heart like I really belong to my family, and I don't have a very smooth relationship with them, and essentially, I'm a little bit wounded in the family attachment department. So one of the results of that then has been that the teaching that I, as a self, am basically empty is simultaneously kind of comforting, like, oh, it confirms the thing that I already feel, but also not entirely appropriate for me all the time. And that it actually, at times, has been appropriate for me to go into different contexts, like attachment-based therapy, and try to reassemble the sense of myself as a child within an intact family stream. Even though, you know, the teaching on emptiness and the Four Noble Truths says that's just flickering conditions not to be grasped at, right? The teaching that it's empty is ego dystonic. It's not good for the ego. But attachment repair wants to be ego syntonic. It wants to support the ego, right? So if you want to think about this in a simple way, when there's a lot of trauma, we need to build up the sense of self. When there's a lot of oppression, we need to build up the sense of self and identity. When there's enough healing or enough shelter or privilege or comfort or non-oppression, then there may be a natural turn toward, like, oh, I could let that go. Okay? And we see this when, for instance, an oppressed group, through whatever historical forces, often assimilation, finds themselves less oppressed. Right? So, where are the Irish and Italian activists in the United States right now, protesting for their rights as Catholics in the United States? Terrible oppression against Irish and Italian Catholics in the United States. That was true 100 years ago. It was even true 50 years ago. Right? The argument in my lifetime was whether we could tolerate a black president. The argument in my parents' lifetime was whether we could tolerate a Catholic president. Right? John F. Kennedy, he was going to be under the thumb of the Pope. You couldn't trust him. That's mostly gone. Yeah? Although, you know, what would happen if, let's say, Mitt Romney got really close to getting elected. There would be a big conversation about Mormonism. So when the oppression backs off, or the threat backs off, the identity can soften, the ego can soften its defenses. All of this, then, to me, suggests that there's something missing for many of us, even between these basic prerequisites: be ethical, give, be engaged with the fruits of your actions, recognize pleasures, recognize renunciation, and these deconstructive teachings on emptiness, on radical interdependence, on impermanence. And when I think about this, the place where my attention has gone is to the fact that so many people right now lack the basic safety and comfort in the material realm to be able to do those deconstructive inquiries. In other words, if you're under threat in a basic material way, if there's not enough food, enough shelter, enough medicine, enough clothing, are you going to meditate? Are you going to like close your eyes and relax and dissolve your sense of self into open relaxation? Probably not. And maybe it's not the right thing for you to do. Like maybe it would be better to work on stabilizing housing, for instance. So this is a list called the four requisites. And these are the four requisites that monastics, monks and nuns, in the renunciate life, chant prayers of gratitude to every day. These are the four things that are given freely to monks and nuns. So food, shelter, clothing, medicine. They are material, they're physical, they guarantee the safety and health of this body. They're essentially the things you need to not to escape poverty, right? Food security, housing security, clothing security. That one seems minor because there's so much disposable clothing nowadays, but there didn't used to be. And it's still not the case for everyone, right? And then healthcare, right? Hashtag healthcare as a human right. Hashtag Medicare for all, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, politics. And it's a requisite. You have to have it. If you don't have access to it, much more difficult. And so if we think about this list, we can think about like, oh, the monastics, the ones going into profound renunciation, like I'm going to let go of all of the securities of the household life, I'm going to let go of identity, I'm going to let go of ownership. They were doing that not in the context, we talked a couple weeks ago about like homeless encampments and how that might be different from, you know, like monks and nuns living in the wilderness in a kind of volitional or choice way. And this is one of the differences. The monks and nuns would leave the home life for the wilderness, but what they would need in order to do that is these four gifts: food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. And so what happens once you have those? Even if you own nothing else, if what you own is three robes, you know, three articles of clothing, basically, and the shelter you live in is donated, and it might even just be like a tree, like you do the ascetic practice of living outside under a tree, but you have some shelter, or you have that, there's no robbers or bandits or, you know, floods or something there. It's a spot you could live, or a hut that someone built you. You have clothing, you have the hut. The monks and nuns in the Theravada system go begging or go on alms round with their bowls for food once a day. And of course, if the requisite of food isn't coming, like if you live in an area where people aren't generous to monastics, you leave. You know, it's not like you're going to be like, okay, I've let go of grasping at anything, so nobody's put anything in my bowl for a month. I guess I'm just going to keep trying and slowly starve, right? That's not the instruction. The Buddha's instruction is, you know, if you're not getting good alms, leave. Go somewhere else. Like, go to a place that'll support you in your practice. Like, that was the point. The whole point was to be able to practice. So it's not about denying yourself health or well-being in any way. It's actually about creating the best conditions for liberation practice. So if that's the case, then, in a culture now where there's virtually no monastic option, there's a very tiny monastic option. You can go be a monk or a nun. It's not hardly as easy as it used to be, or as it is in other places in the world. It's possible, but it's not very robust. And so you're mostly on your own. And so what then becomes possible in a culture where so many people, including in various ways some of us, depending on how much privilege we carry, are actually denied these basic requisites? In other words, can you even go on in your practice? Or, you know, we might think about poor folks. Let's say you got a job, let's say you do social work or some kind of social service for your work, and you work at, say, a homeless shelter, and they say, oh, would you teach some mindfulness, some Buddhism to these folks? And it might be a wonderful thing to do, of course, right? To teach practices that lead to relaxation and calm. But what if they said something like, would you actually start a small Buddhist study group here and really start to investigate some of the deeper truths of this tradition? If I got that invitation, I would say, wow, that's kind of an amazing inspiration to have. Why? Like, what exactly are we aiming for in doing that? Because my system would go toward saying something like, we're really trying to work on basic security for these folks. You know, basic access to the four requisites. And then because there's undoubtedly trauma of all kinds, including systemic oppressions, and historical oppressions, etc., in this group of folks who are houseless. What do they actually need? So I would never go in and say, like, okay, here, let's do a Buddhist study group. I might go in and say, you know, oh, let's all get together in a circle and check in and hear about how you're doing and what you're needing and what you're attaining, what you're finding in your process. And I would want to say, like, what do you need? And I, you know, 100% bet you that nearly nobody is going to say, I'm really excited to do some deeper study into, you know, existential philosophies. The occasional person will. But mostly I think people, you know, are going to say, like, you know, all the things that social workers do, right? I need help on this job application or to deal with, you know, these bills or this medical care or this housing process or that. It's, you know, to do the Western referent, like, right, this is the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy. You can't go up towards spiritual revelation or even, like, deeper creativity and things until the requisites are at least somewhat in place. So then I'm proposing that between these basic, like, ethical action prerequisites that everyone can take on, you know, behave in a kind and non-harming way as best you can, and before one gets to the deconstructive dharmas, we want to turn our attention to the material world and to the realities of living in a culture that denies so many people these basic requisites, and where there's no out. There's no, you know, in Thailand, becoming a monk is sometimes jokingly referred to as the farmer's retirement plan. Like, you farm the fields all your life, you never really accumulated savings, it's not like you have a retirement plan. There's no 401k for a subsistence farmer, you know. And so then you become a monk when you can't farm anymore. And the monastery takes care of you. And what you get is very basic, right? You get a room, one meal a day, maybe two, depending on where you are. Your robes, a couple of robes to keep you dry, and, you know, and some medicines. That's it. You know. And how different would this culture be if there was that option? Yeah, if folks who were struggling, rather than just being told that they needed to somehow work harder, that there was a place to go where in exchange for joining the renunciate life, which means celibacy and poverty, essentially, intentional poverty, and soloness in this world, you would live communally in an ideally, at least, right? And it's not always like this in the monasteries either, but in an ethical community of people attempting to follow these teachings in a wholesome way. That's a pretty compassionate society, I think, that maintains that option for folks. And a pretty harsh society that refuses it. So, for those of us who are privileged, I think this is an encouragement to not take anything for granted at all. To not take clothing, shelter, food, medicine for granted. Really, any day of the week now, there could be a cataclysm such that the shelves of Whole Foods are emptied of kombucha and everything else, right? And, you know, and if you're like, you know, if you're a little insouciant about it and you're like, I'll deal, you know, think about what it's like when you can't get your thing, right? The kind of coconut oil you like, the green juice you like, you know. And then like, oh, what would it really be like? Does anyone come from a culture that experienced this in your lifetime? Like empty shelves, no bread, no vegetables? Yeah? This is absolutely real for so many people on the planet right now, right? We just happen to be extremely fortunate that it's not here. I think the teaching on the four requisites, it says, don't ever forget this. Don't ever take it for granted. And this is why the monks and nuns, they chant it every day. Gratitude for this food. May it continue to be available and nourish beings. I'll end just by saying that I think that this reflection is one of the reflections or recollections that helps turn the attention of you might say privileged Western spiritual practitioners in whatever tradition, yoga, Buddhism, let's say, and the convert traditions, the wealthy traditions, turns us toward the imperative of a certain kind of activism or social awareness. It's really to say, you can't practice unless the foundation of material security is present. Material security includes freedom from oppression and violence. Therefore, if we care about providing for others or supporting the conditions for others to practice and to encounter these transformative teachings that have moved us, we must also then care about social conditions and work to change them. So. So take a moment before we open into discussion. And just flash on in the heart, you might, like any way that you can feel the precarity of your situation, materially speaking. And the way that your material situation, the resources that you have access to, are so intimately interwoven with the whole rest of the situation on the planet. That to tend the planet might, as we grow wise, become as natural to us as tending our own body. Really feel that there might not be food tomorrow. There probably will be, but it's possible that there won't be. You probably will go home to your shelter. Gratitude for that, but you might not. And if this isn't an appropriate reflection for you right now, let it go, right? This is the hinge toward the renunciate dharmas. But it's also just true. And actually, this is one of those that folks who have been vulnerable or poor totally get this one. Yeah? This is one that's harder for the privileged. You have to wake up to the fact that your privilege is temporary, based in conditions, fleeting, can't be guaranteed. And there's a kind of quivering or tenderness or raw openness in the heart, perhaps, as we touch into that. Seeing what arises as you feel in that direction for a moment. So that's the hint at loss. Now we'll bookend, we'll come right back to where we started the meditation. And just for a moment, gratitude. Loss is inevitable, but it hasn't happened yet. Gratitude for the presence of the requisites in our lives, for the food we ate today and will eat tomorrow, for the shelter that we rested in today, in this moment and tomorrow, for these clothing and these medicines. Gratitude. Here I want to say that E.E. Cummings poem, but I only know the first couple lines by heart. I thank you, God, for most this amazing day, for the leaping greenly spirits of trees. It goes on from there. It's good. Go look it up. For everything that is beautiful, that is wonderful, that is yes. Something like that. Your thoughts and feelings, anything that arises for you as we reflect in this way.
When I grew up in Japan, you know, we couldn't even leave like a grain of rice on a bowl.
Yeah.
This is the labor of the farmers and they're coming from the sun.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the culture I carried.
Yes.
But here, if we have really hard time telling my son for that, you know, and my husband is like, well, just because he doesn't eat food here doesn't help kids in Africa. And then, like, that's true, but, like, I think I have a difficulty conveying that message to you. So if you have any advice.
You know, you're describing coming from a culture that understood the preciousness of the resource of a single grain of rice, you know. And you're coming from a heritage Buddhist country where this value is also deeply embedded. Right? There's a Zen story that you may know about a student who heard about this great monastery he was going to study. He's walking through the woods on the trail leading up to the monastery. There's a stream there. And in the old kitchens, the story goes, they would divert a bit of the stream to flow through a channel in the kitchen and use it to wash with, and then it would just flow back out into the stream. So the student is coming up the path toward the monastery and sees a lettuce leaf or, you know, some leaf floating down the stream. In other words, the cook was careless and was washing and lost a leaf and it was, you know, being wasted floating down the stream. And the student immediately starts to turn around and says, oh, this can't be a monastery worth practicing at, right, if they would be that careless. But then the student sees the cook spatula in hand, apron dirty, running down the path to get the lost leaf. And he says, oh, it's a good place, it's a good place. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a mistake, but he or she cares and is going after it. So, you know, many traditional cultures carry this reverence for food, we could say, you know, born of scarcity. Like, you know, it's not like there's enough to waste. And around here, through, we could say, the violence of the modern global system, in this place, there seems to be enough to waste. So much is wasted, right? And maybe it's technically true, right? Like, oh, you know, the food that I waste on my plate, we can't, as it were, send it to another part of the world where folks are starving. But what would this culture be like if we could actually become that reverent for our resources, for our food? So you asked a very practical question about, like, how could I teach this to my child who's growing up in a culture of the disposable, in a culture of waste, even though we come from a heritage culture that is reverent. And I do not have any great answer to that in relation to parenting. But I know in the attempt in parenting my own son, I think so much of the time about how all of the little actions that we do through the day matter in terms of teaching values. That, like, one of the main things I'm doing is teaching values. So, you know, like, the discipline that I give him, what I tell him, you know, the things that he can whack with his bat, for instance, in the house, is mostly about value. Right? It's like, no, well, you can't hit plants because they're alive. And I'll try to make a thing of it. You know, if he does it, we'll actually stop and see the plant and see the damage and say, like, oh, did you forget? It seemed exciting to hit the plant, but look, the plant is hurt. And I'll say, I'm sorry, plant. You know, please feel better. Like, I make it into a thing because I want to teach the value. So I'm improvising there. You know, I don't know what the result will be. He could very well grow up and be like, oh my god, my crazy Buddhist hippie parents, they did all this stuff. They talked to plants, you know, which is true. And but I think in a certain way, this is the heart of parenting that you're attempting to do, is to teach a subtle but important cultural value. You know, and then however you find to do that, whether you make it like, this is something that we do because we are Japanese, like, you could make it a cultural thing, or you could make it a more universal thing, like, this is something we do because it's right, or because it is, because, you know, however you spin it, it's teachable. You know, we grow up with values in various ways. And it might well be that the most important thing that you as parents could do to teach that value is just to do it yourself. Like, my child is the one at playgroup who cleans up. He wants to wipe the table and get every last crumb. Not because I'm, you know, a parent who tells him to do his chore. It's because I am a slightly obsessive table cleaner. And I am constantly cleaning the table. I do that. So, like, he does it, right? And the things that I don't do, he doesn't do. So, or that, you know, that we don't do, he doesn't do. So, I don't know. But I think if you really do it, and your husband really does it, and you get on board together, probably that's important, something will transmit. You know, that's my guess. Thank you for asking. Parenting. Any other thoughts here?
This discussion actually reminds me of something that happened while I was traveling a few years ago. And I was traveling through Central and South America, and I had taken a flight to get to Guatemala, and I was making my way through. And then when I was in Colombia, I was going from a northern city to, like, a city in the center. and it would have been the easiest to take a flight, but I just felt so, like, it's like I've, you know, I've flown too much on this trip. My carbon footprint is way too big. Like, I was just imagining all the destruction, you know, that I was doing from flying. So I decided to take a 20-something hour bus ride instead. And I remember I was telling some other travelers about this, and one of them said, well, you know, the flight's going to leave without you anyway. Like, it's still going to leave. And I very much picked up, like, there was a very, like, kind of facetious tone. And after taking that in, like, I kind of realized, oh, there's some defensiveness there. Like, you know, there's a quality of, like, seeing the way that I'm touched and hurt by my own understanding of the damage I'm doing, and maybe he's touching into that too, and like reflecting in a way that's harsh and not wanting to feel that within himself.
Yeah.
And I just responded, and I was like, yeah, that's true, it is going to leave without me. And I was like, but I also believe that the more demand we put out there, the more they're going to offer those flights. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to just make it known that there's one less person, you know, on a flight.
Yeah.
And he, like, you know, shook his head, and he responded very respectfully to that response. But it just kind of reminded me of what you were talking about with your husband, and that, like, maybe it's, I mean, I'm not sure if defensiveness or anything is what's happening, but, like, sometimes I think it's really hard for people to reflect on sometimes, like, what, when they hear something that's, like, touching them and moving them, and then seeing, like, oh, this is not aligned with what I'm doing. It can, like, create that cognitive dissonance that, like, creates somewhat more of a reaction than the heartfelt response that, you know, we may be coming from.
Yeah. We're in a very competitive culture right now, such that, like, you tell this person that you're doing something because you have an ethical impulse, and the thing that they hear is, oh, does that mean that the thing that I'm doing is bad?
Right.
Right? Like, that's the worst message to get. That's not what you were saying at all.
Right.
And so your response is, you know, is very much just in line with the sincerity of your value mm-hmm. in doing it. You're like, yeah, but, you know, supply and demand. This is my statement. Mm-hmm. And you might also notice, I would imagine this is also true, that there's a layer of it that is not even just supply and demand in terms of the external results of your actions, which is true, mm-hmm. but that there's also an internal result, and that an equally valid response would be something like, I'm not doing it for them. I'm doing it for me. I'm doing it because my actions matter to me.
Yeah.
You know? Our friend Elise just traveled entirely around the world. She circumambulated the world without an airplane. She took a freighter train, a freight boat, ship, liner,
carrier,
yeah, right? A thing with lots of metal containers across the entire Pacific Ocean, right? Did this put a dent in global air travel? Like, of course not. But did it change Elise's life and the life of her family and friends who tracked her doing this and who might consider doing something, even a fraction that radical themselves, like not fly when you could take a less intensive mode of transit, bring consciousness even to the act? Like, what a beautiful gift for her to do that. Whatever its impact, we don't know the impact, you know. Don't take it personally, but this is a path of purification, right? It is actually possible to attend to clarifying your actions in the world and making radical choices to cause less harm. And what an amazing thing to do if you have enough stability in the heart to be able to let go of something that you have before now clung to. Good thing to do. Beautiful practice. So this ends our tour of the prereqs You all have completed your prerequisites, and now you can go on into the, you know, the course that comes next. What we're going to do next, for starting next week and going through April, is we're going to systematically go through formal insight meditation practice, really satipatthana meditation practice, the foundations of mindfulness, using a structure that's taught by one of the Western Theravada world's most extraordinary scholars right now, the Venerable Analio, who has a system that I will say lots more about for the next 2 months, but essentially breaks down the four foundations of mindfulness into seven discrete reflective practices, reflecting on the nature of the body, the elements, death, feelings, mind states, hindrances, and the factors of awakening. It's a beautiful sequence, and it's a meditation that you can do. So as I start to post those, I will also post on the website links to a couple of guided meditations that he has on YouTube that I encourage you to do if you are drawn to that kind of practice, and to his book on Satipatthana meditation, which is published by Windhorse. And again, if you get into this, I really just encourage you to get that book. I'll bring it each week that we do this, and you'll be able to see it. And we will take a look at this this new, essentially, which really means like reassembled from the very, very, very ancient system of practice that is different than probably anything that you've gotten in Western insight meditation. Up to this point, I think it's among the most radical and beautiful and effective bodies of practice around right now. That's the teaser trailer. You totally want to learn this practice. It's gorgeous. It starts next week. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you for your generosity in supporting the group. Thank you.